Welcome back to the last hour of this very special edition of the Tobler program. We thank you for joining us as we celebrate America's birthday. Despite those on the left who would like to see America fall, those of us on the right were happy that the Supreme Court did tact towards a more constitutional construct in its most recent term, and especially in the era of limiting government regulatory authority, although they may have misstepped on one, at least according to those of us who would like to see tight borders, because after all, as Donald Trump says, without borders, you don't have a country. And none other than Andrew Art Arthur joins us now from Center for Immigration Studies to help us unpack the Supreme Court Remain in Mexico decision. And Art, thank you for joining us on this holiday weekend.
You bet, and thank you for having me, Randy.
You can read Art's blogs on CIS.org. It's my go-to resource for immigration matters. And despite, I think, a lot of us being deflated by the Supreme Court's affirmation of Biden's rescission of Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, that's hard to decipher, you gave some hope in your blogs that maybe there is another route to try to, you know, stop some of the tide across the border and maybe either reinstate that policy or do something else. Help us unpack maybe another way forward. Well, first of all, the legalistics of the decision, and then maybe another way forward.
Well, yeah. Chief Justice Roberts issued a very narrow opinion in this case, and basically he found three things. One, the statutory provision that undergirds Remain in Mexico is discretionary, and for that reason, the executive branch can't be forced to implement that program. The second thing that he found was that termination of Remain in Mexico, there have been two, and the Supreme Court found that the lower courts only considered the first one. They hadn't considered the second one, and that they should consider the second one, and they remanded the case back for them to do so. And the third thing that the court found, and this is probably a little late for all those people who suffered through the injunctions that were implemented against Donald Trump's immigration policies, that, you know, those class-wide injunctions are not permitted under the Immigration and Nationality Act. So, again, that one came a little bit too late, but, you know, should give hope to anybody who is looking forward to a Ron DeSantis administration or Kristi Noem or any other Republican administration out there that's probably going to try and tighten up on the immigration laws. So, you know, it was not a completely unalloyed victory, but it wasn't, you know, a total defeat. So that case now goes back to those lower courts. Judge Matthew Kaczmarek down in the Northern District of Texas in the Fifth Circuit, who have both shown themselves to be willing to listen to claims made by states that say that, you know, this massive wave of illegal immigration is causing, you know, is raising costs in their states. And it's taking away job opportunities for their citizens. So, yeah, it's going to go back to the courts. It's also important to note, Randy, that the biggest issues in this case, that is whether the Biden administration is required by law to detain all those illegal migrants that come in, and whether it has the ability or is properly releasing those aliens into the United States. Those are still open questions. And Chief Justice Roberts said, look, I'm not going to decide these today because we don't have to decide those issues to decide this case.
So, yeah, that was interesting. So the first element was DHS. I guess the text of the statute says they may invoke this Remain in Mexico policy. It's not must, right? So that was the specific, you know, legislation that gave the Biden administration authority to not invoke it, while Trump could, and a new Republican administration could re-invoke it, as I understand. What's that second? What are the second and third specific things that this court's going to maybe deal with now? And it was, I think, it was a Missouri and Texas challenge to the policy. But what are the things now that the Fifth Circuit either has to or will deal with? Will it take a separate a question in front of them, or does that question remain in front of that court? And what is that question?
Yeah, so probably, and again, it was the attorneys general of Texas and Missouri that brought that challenge. So the remaining questions are going to be for the court. Well, what the courts are going to be doing next is looking at the second termination memo that was issued by DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. He actually issued two. The first one if you remember, went all the way to the Supreme Court much earlier at the end of last year when the administration attempted to get a stay of it. The Supreme Court refused to stay the judge's order enjoining that. So it got bounced back down, and that was really, it was only that first termination decision. 4 days before the oral argument before the Fifth Circuit, probably not the best thing way to handle your case, Mayorkas terminated MPP again. And so it's going to be that second termination on October 29, 2021, that the courts are going to be considering now. And it's going to be in the context of that that they're going to be considering whether the Biden administration has the ability to do what it's doing right now, releasing tens of thousands of aliens at the southwest border. I think you and I have discussed this before about the number of releases, but they're now up to 1,050,000 plus aliens who have been released just under the Biden administration, just since the day after the inauguration. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they're going to be considering whether the Biden administration is required to detain those aliens and whether it can release them. And those are really the big questions in this case, but that's probably going to get left over until the next Supreme Court term.
In reading about this and thinking about it, I understand that DHS, I guess, does have the authority. I thought it was a Justice Department matter. I mean, you would think it would be a Justice Department matter. Or you were involved in the immigration court system. And it would seem to me as though those judges should decide whether someone should be paroled into the states or not. But DHS actually has that authority. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. In fact, immigration judges don't have the authority to parole anybody into the United States. It's strictly a DHS authority because it is so narrowly, Congress only gave the administration a very narrow grant. It can only be done on a case-by-case basis. It can only be done for urgent humanitarian reasons. That is, you got to go to the hospital directly or for significant public benefit. Traditionally, Randy, that's been read as we need to have you in some criminal court in the United States, either as a witness or a defendant. But the way that the Biden administration views that, you know, significant public benefit is, well, it's a significant public benefit if we don't have space that we release you. And that's really going to be the question. You know, but you know, you have to understand probably half of the Supreme Court argument involved that, and neither of the parties, and again, the AG of Missouri wasn't there, the Solicitor General of Texas did the case. Neither one of them really had a very good answer for, you know, all those questions the Supreme Court had. So the day before this decision came out, I actually, you know, look, I didn't really, I thought the Supreme Court was just going to issue an opinion, but I didn't put it outside the realm of possibility that they would have either set this case over for additional oral argument because the first one wasn't very good, or alternatively would have bounced it down to the lower courts to make some determinations. And in fact, Justice Amy Coney Barrett said, yeah, we probably should have sent this back down to the lower courts. And Kavanaugh said, yeah, we probably should have sent it over for, you know, more oral argument. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, actually it was Justice Alito who said that. But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, these are, you know, real issues that have yet to be decided. But as you and I both know, the real decision is going to be the one that the voters make in November. Because if a Republican House of Representatives comes in, a Republican Senate or both, the landscape's going to change. Congress has the power of the purse, and they can take away Alejandro Mayorkas' salary and parking space if they don't like what he's doing. They can defund all of these paroles that are going on. They can fund additional detention space. So that's really the issue. The Democrats who've controlled Congress for the last number of years have gradually been cutting the detention space that's available. The Republicans, if they take over, will probably come in and beef that up significantly and start to put some pretty stringent rules in the Biden administration for what it's doing at the borders.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, tactically, unless there's a supermajority, I mean, you know, to overcome a filibuster in the Senate, which will not happen, even if Republicans were to get a majority in the Senate, there are still some things that could be done with, let's say, theoretically, both houses of Congress controlled, even though the Senate wouldn't have that supermajority. So things could be done through the power of the purse, maybe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, part of the reason why we've seen Democrats try to use spending bills in order to, you know, make changes to avoid the filibusters, because those spending bills aren't subject to filibuster rules. Under the Byrd rule, they go straight through on a party, or they go straight through on a majority vote. So it really is that funding, that power of the purse. The, you know, Republicans in Congress actually really just haven't used it, you know, when they've been in control in the last few Congresses. But, you know, this is a subject where they're going to get a lot of pressure from their constituents to actually do something. So I think they're going to use that power. In fact, we might see this come up even before the next Congress, because there's probably going to be a supplemental border bill. As you and I have also discussed, Title 42 is on the chopping block. The Biden administration wants to end those CDC orders directing DHS to expel illegal migrants from the United States. And in fact, even the Biden administration sent about half of those people home under that Title 42. But Biden also wants to end Title 42, which will probably lead to about 18,000, up to 18,000 illegal migrants showing up at the southwest border every day. When that happens, it's just going to be, you know, what is a disaster is going to become a catastrophe down there. You know, both for our national sovereignty, but for those, you know, towns along the southwest border that just aren't prepared for this. So it has to be a supplemental spending bill, and the Republicans could act on that.
Okay, well, that gives us hope, and that's why I like talking to you, because I think sometimes we look at the high-level view of these decisions, and everyone begets, well, folks that want border security are just one after another. We see these actions by the Biden administration, and now, in this case, upheld by the court. We go like, wow. Might as well just open the floodgates. I mean, you can hear the frustration when Border Patrol agents are interviewed, and it seems like they're nothing more than welcome wagon hosts now for the to implement the policies of open borders. And it's good to hear that there may be a way to stem the tide a little bit, depending on the outcome of the midterms. So that should motivate listeners to get out there and let it be known that they can make a difference by advocating for border security, pro-border security candidates this fall. They can make a difference ahead of 24.
Absolutely, yeah. And remember that a Border Patrol wife is now going to be in the United States Congress. Myra Flores won a special election in the Texas 34th District, winning a seat that Democrats had held for 100 years. So, yeah, their Border Patrol is now going to have a voice on Capitol Hill.
All right. Art Arthur, thanks for joining us on this holiday week, and it means a lot that you would spend some time with us. I always appreciate your deep insight into this. And again, folks, I would commend you to reading everything that Art blogs about on Center for Immigration Studies website, CIS.org. Thanks, and happy birthday, America, to you, Art Arthur, a great defender of our borders. We appreciate you very much.
Happy 4th of July, Dr. Tobler.
All right. Take care. There he is, Art Arthur. When we come back, Paul Manafort and his new book, and when we'll unpack a lot. His new book, Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced. He's defiant in the wake of pleading guilty to spending time in jail and then being pardoned by Donald Trump. We'll talk with Paul Manafort straight ahead. Well, here I was all excited about talking to and challenging Paul Manafort, the maligned, convicted, and formerly guiltily pled campaign manager briefly for Donald Trump when he was recruited in, June of 2016 through August of 2016 to fight back the never Trump wing of the Republican Party. A storied history in terms of Republican circles starting way back in the Reagan administration. A very, very wealthy and successful lobbyist on behalf of many foreign leaders, including oligarchs in Russia, Ukraine, even involved Bob Dole in one of his schemes to the recently departed Dole, who was recruited to lobby in behalf of a Russian oligarch who wanted to gain some access here. So his book is coming out soon, and we hoped to get him through this break. Max has been trying over and over again. And Max, I'm not normally one to diss people who don't meet their obligations to us because, hey, it happens. I mean, people sometimes time zones get mixed up and so forth. But in this case, I guess I may be particularly suspicious, disappointed, and frankly peeved that a guy who has a checkered past, we have to say that, recent past, with just an avalanche of accusations and pleading guilty and then being on home arrest after he was jailed for, what, 4 or 5 years. And then there were punitive sentences put on top of that because of his tampering with witnesses. And then he was pardoned by Donald Trump. He was let out of jail during the COVID because of, you know, the danger to the prisoners and so forth. And he allegedly had some health problems. But it's troubling, isn't it, that a guy wouldn't answer the call?
Well, the thing about it is the PR person that I worked with on this is somebody who has given us many great guests in the past. And it's someone who I have a pretty good working relationship with when they pitched Manafort, who, by the way, is calling us right now. Stand by.
Oh, good. Well, there he is. Looks like we have him now. That's good. Okay. Well, I take back what I said. So we'll be talking to Paul Manafort. And, of course, we're going to give him an opportunity to answer the charges, ask why he pled guilty, and ask the tough questions, but also give him a chance to tell his side of the story. And, you know, I find it to be a compelling opportunity to talk to someone who was prominent in the news, influential throughout Republican past times and presently. So he joins us now. Paul Manafort, author of the upcoming book, Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced. Paul Manafort, welcome to the Randy Tobler Show.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
So I first really put the spotlight on you, and I think when you came to prominence, at least in most Americans' minds who maybe weren't too aware of you, until you became the campaign manager for Donald Trump to fight the Never Trump onslaught late in that campaign and through the party's convention. Tell us about that experience, and if you can relate to us the whole experience of being involved in the Trump campaign and then not being involved in the Trump campaign.
Well, sure. I appreciate that chance. And I get into this in detail in my book. But basically, when Trump announced his candidacy in 2015, he was a one-man show. He basically was the candidate. He was the strategist. He was the communications director. He was the scheduler. He was the pollster. And frankly, through the early primaries, he was brilliant. And the campaign really came together. He came out of a field of 16 to take the lead early and maintained it on a regular basis. But the nominating process in the Republican Party, you know, is not just based on winning primaries. The key is winning delegates, because the nomination process results in a convention, and you have to have the requisite number, majority number, to be the nominee. In the Republican Party, however, the rules of how delegates are selected vary by state. So it doesn't matter if you win the primary in most states. It matters if you win the delegates. Some states will allow the primary winner to get, you know, his percentage of the delegates. Others will have a complete bifurcation between delegates selected in the primaries. Trump, you know, was not a political person. He was a citizen running because he thought he could make a difference. And so he didn't understand the rules of the party, and no one in the campaign did at that point. And so when Cruz and Kasich and the rhinos, the anti-Trumpers, started to realize Trump was going to be sweeping the public support, they started to change their game plan and try to look towards second ballot victory, where they would have a majority of delegates on the floor, even if they hadn't won the majority of state in the primaries. That's one of my expertises. And I had known Trump for over 20 years. He was one of the first clients of my firm, Blackman at Wharton Stone, in the 1980s. And although Roger Stone was the point guy on dealing with Trump, now I've been involved with some of the projects for him as well, so I knew him. So at that point, Roger suggested to Trump that he talk to me, and he did, and I got involved in the campaign. The rest is sort of history.
Yeah, and I think, we saw in this recent Supreme Court term how the court has been turned around and finally returning to constitutional conservatism and originalism, and it was great to see. So elections do have consequences. Now, so does behavior. And that's what your book is about. It is my promotional material says a riveting account of the hoax that sent a presidential campaign chairman to solitary confinement because he wouldn't turn against the president of the United States. I mean, you were convicted on multiple charges. You pled guilty. You were later pardoned by Donald Trump. You apparently suffered a lot of health and infirmities as a result of your solitary confinement. How are Americans who watched that unfold, the Mueller prosecution, in the context of what was going on in the fake, phony Russian dossier and how that clouded the whole Trump administration, help Americans who want to hear both sides of the story and seemed with the legacy media only to hear the government side of the story? Help us process that. I mean, you pled guilty ultimately. You were punitively sentenced because of witness tampering. And I'm not asking you to recap the whole book here in the next 5 or 10 minutes, but I wanted folks to hear your side of the story on this 4th of July weekend. It's your turn.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I do set it all out in great detail in the book and in a way that was very understandable, although it's tough to do in a couple of minutes on the radio. But the bottom line is it was always a political trial. They knew it. They understood it. They targeted me because they wanted me to give them up Donald Trump, which I wouldn't do. I couldn't do it if I told the truth, and I wasn't going to lie. So when they took charges that I had resolved with the federal government and without any penalties or any convictions, unfair or things like that. But Weissman understood that he had unfettered control, and he also understood the way to get the pressure on me and maybe get a conviction was to basically try me in the court of public opinion before he could try me in the court of judicial opinion. And that's what he did. When they indicted me on a charge that I had resolved with the fair unit at the Department of Justice, they immediately did two things. One, they put a $10 million bond on me. That was more than John Gotti got when he was arrested. But they also put a gag order on me, so I couldn't talk in the media. Now, this is after 5 months of tsunami-like negative media coming from leaks in the U.S. government. When they put that gag on me, then the leaks just multiply, and within a couple of months, it was impossible for me to get a fair trial with the gag order on. But even worse, when I got my bail, they finally worked out, which took about 5 months. They sentenced me. They immediately incarcerated me on a trumped-up witness tampering charge. We didn't even have a witness list yet in the trial. There was no witness order. And I never made contact with the person that they said I tampered with. But they used that pretext to put me in solitary confinement. So not only did I have a gag order on me, but now I was in solitary confinement. And worse, they put me 3.5 hours away from my lawyers in a prison. So I couldn't even communicate with them face-to-face before the trial. That's the way they stacked the deck. I can go into all the great details, the charges, and I do that in the book. But the bottom line, it was a political trial. They weren't looking for justice. They were looking for blood. And they wanted me to serve them up Donald Trump, which I wouldn't do.
And I think it's well known to most Americans in their personal life, their reading of the newspaper. Maybe they know people who have been prosecuted that... prosecutors will do what prosecutors do sometimes to try to get some information to prosecute others, right? And they will pressure people. And I think that certainly with a history of lobbying in behalf of foreign tyrants, I don't think there's any other way to package that. I don't think that's illegal, but I think you did get into some trouble by not registering as a foreign agent registration under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or am I wrong?
Well, that's what they indicted me on. But the reality is, I didn't feel like I had the need to register. I hired lobbyists who were registered. But I still worked it out with the fair unit at the Department of Justice prior to the special counsel even being appointed. And they said, look, it was a gray area that was very opaque. We had reached an agreement where I filed a limited filing. No civil penalties, no criminal penalties, because there were criminal actions taken on fair charges at that point in time. There hadn't been one. There's been one in the 70 years history of the law. But I had worked it all out. And there was no question, no penalty, not even a slap on the wrist. Because, and then what Weissmann did is he took control of it. He rejected the agreement, and he brought criminal charges, not civil charges, because that was the way to pressure me.
Okay. So really sort of weaponizing, that's the thesis of your book, is basically the weaponization of justice in the name of political gains. So the book is to be released in August. Is that right, or has it already been released? I understand it's coming out soon.
It's coming out August 16th, although it's available for pre-order today at Amazon Books and at Barnes & Noble's, and I think Simon & Schuster as well.
I'd be curious now, having really been through the trial by fire, literally, and spending time in solitary confinement, I hope, by the way, your health is better. It appeared as though your health deteriorated dramatically, and I hope you've improved.
Well, I've recovered. I have some residual, but nothing major in my life. And,
okay, well, that's good.
24/7 in an 8x10 cell with no light, no windows, and no contact.
I wonder what the theory was there. Was there a thought that you were going to harm yourself or harm others? I mean, I think of solitary confinement for people that took a seat in Nancy Pelosi's desk. That was tongue-in-cheek, Paul. But, I mean, it seems as though when the government wants to, they can really put people in solitary confinement. But when former security officials and CIA officials lie to Congress, that's okay. They get a job with CNN. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The ostensible reason was for my protection. Frankly, I didn't need to be protected in prison. Most people in prison actually were supporters of Donald Trump because they saw what he was doing on criminal justice reform and what he was doing in helping their families with their economic program. But that was the ostensible reason, just to protect me from the prisoners. But that wasn't the real reason. The real reason was, and it's, Weissmann has a history of this, putting people in solitary confinement to try and break them. And with me, he failed.
We're talking with Paul Manafort, political author of Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced, coming out in August. Last question for you. With your knowledge of inner knowledge of the workings of government, being certainly on the losing end of the working ends of government and justice and the miscarriage of justice, at least by your estimation and your reporting in this book, will Donald Trump be prosecuted as a result of the January 6th committee hearings? And how do you think that may come out? What is your reading of the tea leaves for Donald Trump, both in the justice realm and in the political realm in his future?
Well, the right answer is he won't be prosecuted because there's no basis to prosecute him. He shouldn't have been impeached either. But as long as the Democrats control levers of the Congress, they can act arbitrarily, act improperly, and do what they need to do. I mean, they've proven over the last 7 years that they will weaponize the Department of Justice, they will weaponize the law enforcement agencies, and they will lie to the American people. So that's a powerful potion of not following our constitutional rights. But I don't think he will be indicted. And frankly, if he did, I don't think it would impact in the long run if a decision of his to run for president. I mean, he certainly wouldn't be convicted between now and 2024. And as president and candidate, he can run. Now, what does it do to his political prospects? Frankly, his political prospects are, I think, by the Biden record. And the Biden record is pretty clear. It's a failed record. And in fact, when you look at Trump's successes in the economy and energy independence, on putting America first, on border security, his biggest wins are Biden's biggest losses. And who suffers? The American people. I think today, and you're seeing this in the polls that are talking about a Republican tsunami really in November, the American people are saying, okay, we've learned. We realize who is president matters. And it's a clear choice between what's in their best interest and what's not when you stack up Donald Trump versus Joseph Biden.
Yeah. All right. Well, Paul Manafort, great analysis. We appreciate that insight and wish the best to you on the book, Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not but not Silenced. And certainly we appreciate your voice this morning.
Thank you very much. Enjoy talking with you. Happy 4th of July.
Same to you. There he is, Paul Manafort. All right. Well, we report. We ask the questions. You decide. More coming up on the Randy Tobler Show here as we wrap it up with Scott Powell, the author of Rediscovering America, in our next and last segment on this 4th of July, Happy Birthday America edition of the Randy Tobler Show. Hey, you know what? It's time that you get back and get your health and your proactive preventive strategies in line. And, you know, there's no better way to do that when it comes to your oral health, your tooth health, your gum health. All of those are so important. And Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles. I have seen Dr. Jay Olmos and Dr. Dan Cusimano and their fabulous team for years, and I can't commend anyone more highly than the team at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles. You know, they can accommodate you, your children, your parents, your friends, and their services include laser dentistry, fast braces, clear aligners, dental implants. Don't forget the cosmetic dentistry and even therapeutic and, yeah, those fun cosmetic options like Botox and dermal fillers, too. Please get to know them. Don't neglect your dental health. It has ramifications throughout your entire body. 636-978-0226, 636-978-0226, or on the web at advanceddentistrynow.com. That's advanceddentistrynow.com. Dr. Jay Olmos, Dr. Dan Cusimano at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles.
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer. On News Talk STL.
Come to decide that the things that I tried will ruin my life just to get high on. When I sit alone, come get a little known, but I need more than myself this time. Step from the road to the...
Well, welcome back to the program on this 4th of July edition of the Tobler Show. And, you know, it's always fun. We've talked with Scott Powell, my guest this segment, before. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and his new book, Rediscovering America, is a fabulous, fabulous read. Caught an article, Scott. Thank you for joining me on this holiday weekend. Appreciate your time today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Special time of
year.
And
I thought you wrote a great article that I caught called The Key to America's Survival. And it really, really does, I think, help renew hope that maybe, especially on the heels of this Supreme Court term, which I think on balance helped set a new direction in terms of constitutional first principles. And it was a pretty good prescription that you had. Why don't you summarize the key to America's survival when many people think America's survival is existentially threatened at this time?
Well, it is, but it doesn't have to be that way if Americans get back to their roots and really understand and live out the way our country was formed. It is a country of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so, we should start by, reaching out to friends and family and help people wake up from popular narratives, propaganda, fake news conditioning. There's still a lot of people in the darkness, and it's a shame that our media is the way that it is and that our culture is the way that it is, but we all who care about our country can have an influence on other people, and we should. We're called to do that. We could think of ourselves, each one of us, as Paul Revere's. You know, we have to wake up the people. And some of those are difficult conversations, but they're well worth having. You know, next, I guess we should stay vigilant and be prepared to push back and defend our constitutional rights against those who would deprive us of those rights. We were far too acquiescent during the COVID period. We saw that. We were, on so many different fronts. What happened cannot be allowed to happen again, and we, the people, can prevent that. I guess third, we can anticipate and prepare others to stay the course and vote in the face of increased unrest and disruption. I think we can expect that there will be an effort to disrupt the upcoming elections. And we might see false flag events, and those would be, done to rationalize the change in voting protocols and so forth. And we have to be aware that false flag events can be just that, trying to divert attention, trying to change the way things are done. And last, I guess we have a duty to make sure that patriots volunteer in large numbers to serve in every election polling place and vote counting site, to guarantee full transparency and the prevention of electoral irregularities. We have to have the people's voice heard in our country. We are a constitutional republic. The legitimacy of our government comes from we, the people. And so the vote is very important to protect.
Yeah. And Scott, I just would like your your reaction to an interview that we just had. And tomorrow you can listen to it on our podcast. And I don't know if you were monitoring the program before, but I just got done interviewing Paul Manafort, the guy who was, convicted on several charges of wire fraud, of defrauding the government, and then pled guilty to some charges of witness tampering and so forth. And he's coming out with a new book that says he's a political prisoner, that he was persecuted and prosecuted because of a political agenda. I don't know how much of that is really true or not, but it does seem as though we're at a time in our country where in the light of day, we see people from the left, Democrats, people in the former administration that were with the CIA and National Intelligence, lying to Congress, and nothing touches them. They get a job with CNN. And yet Paul Manafort, who no doubt brushed with danger, right? I mean, he was representing or hiring people who represented foreign tyrants. And, there's these issues. I'm not denying that there may be some culpability there, but there seems to be an unequal application of justice. Well, look at Hillary Clinton with her servers. What would happen if Rick DeSantis was found to have some servers in his bathroom? Do you think he would be treated with the same aplomb? And I think people are getting worried, whether they're from the left or the right, that there may be an unequal application of justice in this country. Can you respond to that?
Well, there is an unequal application of justice, and it's not. It could be to the right, it could be the left. The two-tier justice system protects the left and prosecutes the right. I mean, that's been going on for decades, but it's really intensified and gotten worse and worse. And when you don't punish crime, what happens? You get more of that same crime. So the left is emboldened. It got so emboldened that they pulled off vote fraud in the 2020 election. Now, people may still be in denial of that. That's their problem. But if you go and view the movie 2000 Mules, I think you'll have your eyes opened. There was massive vote fraud. Massive.
And they purposely set up the system to be a fertile seedbed for that. Now, whether it was enough to turn the election or not, I don't know that I actually believe that. I'm not certain. But the point is,
have you seen the movie Rant, Dr. Randy?
I have not. I have not.
Okay, granted, you've got to go see that. You have to see the movie. I can send you the link so you can do it free.
But there are people. There are people that I respect. I mean, Bill Barr is certainly no, fading liberal. And he said, Mr. President, there wasn't enough there to make the difference. And, I think good people within a wide pale of conservative orthodoxy can disagree. But the point is, why did we even get to the question of allowing circumstances of the reaction to a virus, which was an overreaction? And I know that, right? Why did we get to the point where the American people stood for a system that, mailed out ballots to people that were long deceased or weren't even living in the state anymore? You know that whole story. And it just seems as though the acceptance of other than orthodox ways to conduct elections, for crying out loud, has now been thrown out the window. And I think we're at a tipping point in our country. And that's why I'm glad your book, Rediscovering America, really addresses that. I wanted you to comment on something going on in Florida. Rick DeSantis's Department of Education has offered incentives for teachers to take training in basically instilling biblical Christian virtues without teaching Christianity or indoctrinating people, but just those basic fundamental things that John Adams said you needed to have for a sustenance of the Republic. And boy, he's getting castigated over that. I mean, they're getting destroyed down there by the media, but he continues with that. I, for one, am glad to see that kind of a movement returning, those fundamental principles being restored to American education. Do you see that momentum gaining traction throughout the land?
Oh, I do. I certainly do. We don't have we have a political problem, but we really have a moral and spiritual problem. And if we can fix the moral and spiritual problem, the politics will take care of themselves. They really will. Now, that's a long-term effort, but it is great to see people like Governor DeSantis undertaking this, because our society is crumbling from within, and we just can't allow that to happen. Now, you know, and the founders of the country, of course, that were basically of moral Christian value. They didn't intend to create a Christian nation, but they took the ideas of the founding of America were taken right out their biblical ideas, the idea of equality, the idea of freedom, liberty, pursuit of happiness. All these are ideas, are godly ideas. And it's those ideas that fuel the great success of America. And now they're all under threat. So we've got to have a revival. A spiritual revival would be cause for great celebration. And I think it's happening in various places locally. You're not going to hear it, about those developments in the media, but they are happening. And we're living in very exciting times, actually.
Well, that's a great way to wrap up our program. Scott Powell, Senior Fellow at Discovery Institute and author of the book Rediscovering America. Folks, I'd recommend you pick it up. Scott, thank you so much for writing and saying the truth and urging this country to restore itself to that moral and religious people that this Constitution requires. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it.
Okay, wonderful.
There he is. Well, that'll wrap it up. As we wrap up this edition of the Tolbert Show, remember that it is faith, family, and freedom that will restore this country to its standing as the greatest country this planet's ever seen. I commend our closing song to you. Listen to it carefully, live by it, share it with your friends, and enjoy this 4th of July birthday of America. We'll see you next week, folks.
In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me as he died to make men whole.